So last week we started with the Book of Fate and had one of the two cantos, and I thought it was worthwhile to spend another hour on the second canto because of the extraordinary nature of this book. In the first canto of the Book of Fate, we hear the voices of Asvapati, the sattvic point of view, the queen mother, the vital human point of view, Narad, the divine, godly point of view, and Savitri, the heroic soul point of view, towards her fate. And so in that canto, the question of fate is explored by these four points of view with respect to Savitri's fate. And her fate, of course, is death. In the second canto, the discussion of fate takes place in more in the impersonal context of life in general. And so this especially the statements of Narad in this book sound to me like this is as close as we come in the entire work of Sri Aurobindo to something that we might call the doctrine of existence, his doctrine of the meaning of human existence. And so the idea that his intention is to transmit as deep and solid an understanding of the fate of human beings as possible represents, that idea represents a kind of culmination in this epic form of its purpose. And there are other moments where Sri Aurobindo's intention culminates in a book or a canto or something. But here, in this one, we have, I think, the beginning and the end of the whole epic of death. Because all the rest of the book is about that. Death. So why? Why is death so important? Why is death such a sorrowful, painful reality? Why are suffering and death and the tragedy of time experiences that the human being endures during his life? This is a reality that perplexes human beings and has always perplexed human beings. And it's the very problem that Savitri's manifestation is meant to solve. So the solution is given to her in the next book, the Book of Yoga, how to solve this problem. But here, right before that, the problem is being stated in the most emphatic, explicit manner possible. So it's a heavy teaching. At the same time, I would like to say that on a more academic level, it answers the question that is posed by Indian spirituality and Buddhistic, including Buddhistic spirituality. The question that is raised regarding illusion, illusionism, it's very tempting to interpret the Vedantic teaching, point of view, philosophy, and the Buddhistic philosophy in an illusionistic way. The truth is the divine, and everything else is falsehood. This is a popular interpretation. And it leads to the conclusion that existence may as well be left abandoned, and nirvana may as well be the ultimate release. Because if all of this is an illusion anyway, and behind it there is the shining divine truth which we can't see, then we may as well go someplace else where we can see it. And therefore the existence itself is devalued. And this happens not only in Eastern religion, it also happens in Western religion. We endure suffering for as long as we have to, and then the release comes with death. And the resurrection comes whenever the divine decides that it's enough suffering. So, all of that way of understanding existence is more or less normal and common knowledge. But with Sri Aurobindo, something else happens. And we will hear it very clearly in this canto. And here is where he eliminates the possibility of illusionism. Because suffering is not an illusion. It is real. And it has a purpose. And it is an intentional purpose. And an unavoidable purpose. And the only thing is that's an illusion is that we want to believe that it's not real. That it can't possibly be real. That the truth must be something else. And so the traditional ancient way of seeing truth as being on a higher plane and illusion and falsehood being on a lower plane the spirit versus matter is exactly the illusion that Sri Aurobindo wants to break. And so he says, suffering and death are the passage to immortality. And there is no other passage. You don't win it by getting escape into nirvana. And moreover, he says that our fate is death. That's our fate. Because, to quote a line, there is a line here in the middle that we come across in this passage. Death is the spirit's opportunity. So there are many mysterious lines like that in this canto, which I'm going to read. Not the whole canto, but some long passages, because it's in the rhythmic transmission that we go beyond all this kind of mental understanding which I'm now communicating, which is nothing whatsoever. And we come closer to the vibration itself of fate. And so this canto is called The Way of Pain. It's a way, a path. The way of fate. The way of death. The way of pain. That is the teaching. So in the first part of this canto, we get another long lament from Queen Aswapati, and then we get Narad's response, and here is a short passage from the Queen's Lament. By what random accident or governed chance that shaped a rule out of fortuitous steps, made destiny from an hour's emotion, came into the unreadable mystery of time, the direr mystery of grief and pain? Is it thy God who made this cruel law? Or some disastrous power has marred his work, and he stands helpless to defend or save? A fatal seed was sown in life's false start, when evil twinned with good on earthly soil. Then first appeared the malady of mind, its pang of thought, its quest for the aim of life. It twisted into forms of good and ill the frank simplicity of the animal's acts. It turned the straight path hewn by the body's gods. Followed the zigzag of the uncertain course of life that wanders seeking for its aim. In the pale starlight falling from thought's skies. Sorry. Its guides, the unsure idea, the wavering will, lost was the instinct's safe identity with the arrow point of being's inmost sight. Marred the sure steps of nature's simple walk, and truth and freedom in the growing soul. Out of some ageless innocence and peace, privilege of souls not yet betrayed to birth, cast down to suffer on this hard, dangerous earth. Our life was born in pain and with a cry. All walks inarmed by its own opposites. Error is the comrade of our mortal thought, and falsehood lurks in the deep bosom of truth. Sin poisons with its vivid flowers of joy, or leaves a red scar burnt across the soul. Virtue is a gray bondage and a jail. At every step is laid for us a snare. Alien to reason and the spirit's light, our fount of action from a darkness wells. In ignorance and nescience are our roots. A growing register of calamities is the past's account, the future's book of fate. The centuries pile man's follies and man's crimes upon the countless crowd of nature's ills. As if the world's stone load was not enough, a crop of miseries obstinately is sown by his own hand in the furrows of the gods, the vast, increasing, tragic harvest reaped from old misdeeds, buried by oblivious time. He walks by his own choice into hell's trap. This mortal creature is his own worst foe. His science is an artificer of doom. He ransacks earth for means to harm his kind. He slays his happiness and others' good. Nothing has he learned from time and its history. Even as of old in the raw youth of time, when earth ignorant ran on the highways of fate, old forms of evil cling to the world's soul, war making naught the sweet smiling calm of life, Battle and rapine, ruin and massacre are still the fierce pastimes of man's warring tribes. An idiot hour destroys what centuries made. His wanton rage or frenzied hate lays low the beauty and greatness by his genius wrought, and the mighty output of a nation's toil. Think, Baghdad. Think, Hiroshima. Think, Alexandria. Then, after a silence, Narad made reply. Now, listen carefully to the description of Narad that precedes his reply. Then, after a silence, Narad made reply. Tuning his lips to earthly sound, he spoke. And something now of the deep sense of fate weighted the fragile hints of mortal speech. And that now is significant, because it's now that he is going to say these words to us, and they are going to be weighted with a sense of fate. And this is the magic of Savitri. His forehead shone with vision solemnized, turned to a tablet of supernal thoughts, as if characters of an unwritten tongue had left in its breath the inscriptions of the gods. Bare in that light, time toiled, his unseen works detected. The broad-flung, far-seeing schemes, unfinished, which his aeoned flight unrolls, were mapped already in that worldwide look. Was then the sun a dream because there is night? Hidden in the mortal's heart, the eternal lives. He lives secret in the chamber of thy soul. A light shines there, nor pain nor grief can cross. A darkness stands between thyself and him. Thou canst not hear or feel the marvelous guest. Thou canst not see the beatific sun. O Queen, thy thought is a light of the ignorance. Its brilliant curtain hides from thee God's face. It illumes a world born from the inconscience, but hides the immortal's meaning in the world. Thy mind's light hides from thee the eternal's thought, Thy heart's hopes hide from thee the eternal's will. Earth's joys shut from thee the immortal's bliss. Thence rose the need of a dark, intruding God, the world's dread teacher, the creator, pain. Where ignorance is, there suffering too must come. Thy grief is a cry of darkness to the light. Pain was the firstborn of the inconscience, which was thy body's dumb original base. Already slept there, pain's subconscient shape, a shadow in a shadowy, tenebrous womb. Till life shall move, it waits to wake and be. In one call, with joy, came forth the dreadful power. In life's breast, it was born, hiding its twin. But pain came first, then only joy could be. Pain plowed the first hard ground of the world drowse. By pain a spirit started from the clod. By pain life stirred in the subliminal deep, interned, submerged, hidden in matter's trance, awoke to itself the dreamer, sleeping mind. It made a visible realm out of its dreams. It drew its shapes from the subconscious depths, then turned to look upon the world it had made. By pain and joy, the bright and tenebrous twins, the inanimate world perceived its sentient soul. Else had the inconscient never suffered change. Pain is the hammer of the gods to break a dead resistance in the mortal's breast, heart. His slow inertia as of living stone. If the heart were not forced to want and weep, his soul would have lain down content, at ease, and never thought to exceed the human start, and never learned to climb towards the sun. The ancient mother faces all with joy. Calls for the ardent pang, the grandiose thrill. For with pain and labor all creation comes. This earth is full of the anguish of the gods. Ever they travail, driven by time's goad, and strive to work out the eternal will and shape the life divine in mortal forms. His will must be worked out in human breasts against the evil that rises from the gulfs, against the world's ignorance and its obstinate strength, against the stumblings of man's pervert will, against the deep folly of his human mind, against the blind reluctance of his heart. The spirit is doomed to pain till man is free. Then, from that which I have called the Gnostic Gospel of Suffering, Sri Aurobindo turns to the ultimate example of this fate, the fate of the avatar. Not just the ordinary human and the ignorance and the falsehood, but to the truth itself. The truth conscious being itself. He who would save himself lives bare and calm. He who would save the race must share its pain. This he shall know, who obeys that grandiose urge, the great who came to save this suffering world and rescue out of time's shadow and the law, must pass beneath the yoke of grief and pain. They are caught by the wheel that they had hoped to break. On their shoulders they must bear man's load of fate. Heaven's riches they bring, their sufferings count the price, or they pay the gift of knowledge with their lives. The Son of God, born as the Son of Man, has drunk the bitter cup, owned Godhead's debt, the debt the Eternal owes to the fallen kind. His will has bound to death and struggling life that yearns in vain for rest and endless peace. Now is the debt paid, wiped off the original score. The Eternal suffers in a human form. He has signed salvation's testament with his blood. He has opened the doors of his undying peace. The deity compensates the creature's claim. The creator bears the law of pain and death. A retribution smites the incarnate God. His love has paved the mortal's road to heaven. He has given his life and light to balance here the dark account of mortal ignorance. It is finished. The dread, mysterious sacrifice, offered by God's martyred body for the world. Gethsemane and Calvary are his lot. He carries the cross on which man's soul is nailed. His escort is the curses of the crowd. Insult and jeer are his rights acknowledgement. Two thieves slain with him mock his mighty death. He has trod with bleeding brow the Savior's way. He who has found his identity with God pays with the body's death his soul's vast light. His knowledge immortal triumphs by his death. Hewn, quartered on the scaffold as he falls. His crucified voice proclaims, I am God. Yes, all is God, peals back heaven's deathless call. Yes, all is God. Every atom, every impulse, every tear, every smile, every breath. But to realize it requires sacrifice. Another passage follows this one regarding the sacrifice itself, the nature of sacrifice, which makes it a little bit more general. Hard is the world redeemer's heavy task. The world itself becomes his adversary. Those he would save are his antagonists. This world is in love with its own ignorance. Its darkness turns away from the Savior light. It gives the cross in payment for the crown. His work is a trickle of splendor in a long night. That's why the call is deathless. It continues after the Savior has done his work. The call continues and the sacrifice continues. That's fate. He sees the long march of time, the little one. A few are saved, the rest strive on and fail. A sun has passed. On earth, night's shadow falls. He must call light into its dark abysms. Else never can truth conquer matter's sleep, and all earth look into the eyes of God. All things obscure, his knowledge must relume. All things perverse, his power must unknot. He must pass to the other shore of falsehood's sea. He must enter the world's dark to bring their light. The heart of evil must be bared to his eyes. He must learn its cosmic dark necessity, its right, and its dire roots in nature's soil. He must know the thought that moves the demon act and justifies the Titan's erring pride, and the falsehood lurking in Earth's crooked dreams. He must enter the eternity of night and know God's darkness as he knows his Son. For this he must go down into the pit. For this, he must invade the dolorous vasts, imperishable and wise and infinite. He still must travel hell, the world to save. Into the eternal light he shall emerge, on borders of the meeting of all worlds. There on the verge of nature's summit steps, the secret law of each thing is fulfilled. All contraries heal their long dissidence. There meet and clasp the eternal opposites. There pain becomes a violent, fiery joy. Evil turns back to its original good, and sorrow lies upon the breasts of bliss. She has learned to weep glad tears of happiness. Then shall be ended here the law of pain. Finally, regarding the fate of us, our particular personal fate, this passage is a parallel of one that we read in The Traveler of the Worlds, and it's a parallel of one that we will read again in the Book of Yoga. And it's also a parallel of the very first two pages of the whole of Savitri. This message recurs again and again. O mortal, who complainest of death and fate. Accuse none of the harms thyself hast called. This troubled world thou hast chosen for thy home. Thou art thyself the author of thy pain. Once in the immortal boundlessness of self, in a vast of truth and consciousness and light, the soul looked out from its felicity. It felt the spirit's interminable bliss. It knew itself deathless, timeless, spaceless, one. It saw the eternal, lived in the infinite. Then, curious of a shadow thrown by truth, it strained towards some otherness of self. It was drawn to an unknown face, peering through night. It sensed a negative infinity, a void supernal, whose immense excess, imitating God and everlasting time, offered a ground for nature's adverse birth. And matter's rigid, hard unconsciousness, harboring the brilliance of a transient soul that lights up birth and death and ignorant life. A mind arose that stared at nothingness, till figures formed of what could never be. It housed the contrary of all that is. A naught appeared as being's huge sealed cause, its dumb support in a blank infinite, in whose abysm spirit must disappear. A darkened nature lived and held the seed of spirit hidden and feigning not to be. Eternal consciousness became a freak of an unsouled, almighty, inconscient, and breathed no more as spirit's native air. Bliss was an incident of a mortal hour, a stranger in the insentient universe. As one drawn by the grandeur of the void, the soul attracted leaned to the abyss. It longed for the adventure of ignorance and the marvel and surprise of the unknown and the endless possibility that lurked in the womb of chaos and in nothing's gulf, or looked from the unfathomed eyes of chance. It tired of its unchanging happiness. It turned away from immortality. It was drawn to hazard's call and danger's charm. It yearned to the pathos of grief, the drama of pain, perdition's peril, the wounded bare escape, the music of ruin and its glamour and crash, the savor of pity and the gamble of love and passion and the ambiguous face of fate. A world of hard endeavor and difficult toil and battle on extinction's perilous verge. A clash of forces, a vast incertitude, the joy of creation out of nothingness. Strange meetings on the roads of ignorance and the companionship of half-known souls, or the solitary greatness and lonely force of a separate being conquering its world. Called it from its too safe eternity. A huge descent began. A giant fall. For what the Spirit sees creates a truth. And what the soul imagines is made a world. A thought that leaped from the timeless can become indicator of cosmic consequence and the itinerary of the gods, a cyclic movement in eternal time. Thus came, born from a blind, tremendous choice, this great perplexed and discontented world, this haunt of ignorance, this home of pain. There are pitched desire's tents, grief's headquarters, a vast disguise conceals the eternal's bliss. Read just one more short passage, which is a summary of the way of fate, the way we have chosen. And it follows a very short, sort of timid question by Aswapati, who says, is there no remedy within? Is there no remedy within? O King, thy fate is a transaction done at every hour between nature and thy soul. With God for its foreseeing arbiter. Fate is a balance drawn in destiny's book. Man can accept his fate. He can refuse. Even if the one maintains the unseen decree, he writes thy refusal in thy credit page. Even if the one maintains the unseen decree, He writes thy refusal in thy credit page. For doom is not a close, a mystic seal. Arisen from the tragic crash of life, arisen from the body's torture and death, the spirit rises mightier by defeat. Its godlike wings grow wider with each fall. Its splendid failures sum to victory. O man, the events that meet thee on thy road, though they smite thy body and soul with joy and grief, are not thy fate. They touch thee a while and pass. Even death can cut not short thy spirit's walk. Thy goal, the road thou choosest, are thy fate. On the altar, throwing thy thoughts, thy heart, thy works, thy fate is a long sacrifice to the gods, till they have opened to thee thy secret self, and made thee one with the indwelling God. O soul, intruder in nature's ignorance, armed traveler to the unseen, supernal heights, thy spirit's fate is a battle and ceaseless march against invisible opponent powers, a passage from matter into timeless self. In vain thou mournst that Satyavan must die. His death is a beginning of greater life. Death is the spirit's opportunity. Is called the Book of Yoga, How to Realize It in This Life.
Martin, all together we have to go to immortality, otherwise there is no choice. There is no way otherwise, even before inside the memory. Even if you realize so, you have to pray for the help, for the support, for the lead. There's no way, all together only.
But even after you realize it in this life, according to what we will see in Savitri at the end, death is still an opportunity to bring back to this life a greater leverage over the ignorance.
I mean, because ignorance, cosmic ignorance is always there, till it is completely
transformed.
So, when we identify with the suffering of the world, of course, we can take on us the death of the world.
We can, and we can experience all of that as bliss, but it's still not the end. There's an amazing chapter in The Life Divine which explains that perfectly.
If you take it like this, because I thought completely into this, all the life which you are set on is that described beautifully. In the power of now, Eckhart Tolle speaks of dying before dying. Is it this?
Yes.
Okay.
And the mother does also in the agenda quite a lot.